AFRS Sports Rail.
It's another thrill-packed edition of the AFRS Sports Reel. 15 minutes of colorful yarns about famous events and personalities from the sporting scenes. Our commentators today are Jimmy Young and Bill Brandt. To get things underway, we'll hear from Jimmy Young. Jim's story for today is about Yale's immortal halfback, Albie Booth.
Yale University has had its share of great football players down through the years, but there was one Yale man whose name will never be forgotten on the campus at New Haven. You're sure to remember him. His name was Albie Booth. He weighed in at about 140 pounds, and he was spotting every opponent he ever met, an average of 50 pounds, but artful Albie was a giant killer. The bigger they were, the more they seemed to miss him. He could weave his way through a broken field like a miniature Red Grange. He could dropkick, punt, and pass. He was a sawed-off Superman in the 3 years he played for varsity football at Yale. Booth was a sophomore in 1929. The Eli coaches knew he was good when he reported for practice that fall. But he still was untried against big league competition. Yale came up against Army early in the season. This was the first real test for the Blue and for Booth. The cadets were tall, tough, and terrific. They had a great runner of their own, a fellow named Chris Cagle. Their heavy-handed line was rated one of the best in the nation. Booth was on the bench at kickoff time. The game's first break came early in the first quarter when Army's Cagle intercepted a Yale pass and skirted 57 yards through the Elis for a touchdown. Army made the point, and the score was 7-0 in favor of the cadets. In the second period, Army scored again. This time, it was Hertz Morrell who broke through the Yale line and rambled 29 yards for a touchdown. The kick was missed, but Army still led 13-0. The cheering cadets sat back and dreamed of a big score. On the Yale bench, a little guy in a blue shirt and white helmet got up. He sprinted into the game and reported to the referee. It was Booth. The Army players looked at Albie. They'd heard that he was good, but didn't he know that he was in there with the big boys now? Shortly after the next kickoff, Yale recovered an Army fumble on the cadet 35. In just 5 plays, Booth carried the ball and the Eli scored. The Yale line was charging furiously and Booth was dancing through the holes they made. Albie made the touchdown and then kicked the point. The score was Army 13, Yale 7 as the second period ended. In the third quarter, Yale got the ball on Army's 35. Then it was Booth off tackle, then Booth around end, and then Yale was on the Army 1. Booth hit the center of the line. Army forward submarined the interference. There was only one thing to do, and Albie did it. He dove over the line for a touchdown, and he kicked the point, and Yale led 14-13. The cadets then elected to kick off, as the team scored upon traditionally has its choice of kicking or receiving. The ball sailed downfield to Booth on his own 30. He started upfield with those nervous short steps of his, bobbing, weaving, shifting. Every man on the Army squad had at least one shot at him, and some came back for a second helping. But there was no bringing Albie down. He planted the pigskin and pay dirt behind the Army goal after a 70-yard run. And then he kicked the extra point, and Yale led 21-13. Shortly after that, Booth left the game. There was no more scoring. The game ended 21-13. That night, the football world saluted a new member of the Immortals, a 140-pounder named Albie Booth.
Thanks, Jimmy Young. Before we hear from Bill Brandt with one of his popular once-in-a-lifetime tales, I'd like to tell you about a yarn I heard that I think merits retelling. A wrestling match once played a significant part in molding the destiny of a nation. It was in the year 1520. Francis I of France and Charles V of Austria were eyeing each other with suspicion. War between those two kingdoms was imminent. Francis had great respect for the Austrian army, and as he prepared for battle with his enemy, he tried his best to form a hasty alliance with the mighty Henry VIII of England. On a specified day, the British and French kings met in France. Their meeting place was at a spot between the towns of Ardres and Guinea. While the two monarchs discussed the making of a treaty, grand tournaments were arranged to brighten the festivities. Opposing knights measured their strength and skill at tilting and several other sports, including wrestling. Now, it happened that the English king, Henry, became so excited while watching the wrestling bouts that he offered to wrestle the king of France, Francis. Henry was built very short, broad, and muscular. However, the king of France held the advantage in both height and skill, so Francis accepted Henry's challenge to wrestle. Under the watchful eyes of the assembled crowd of knights and courtiers, the two neighboring kings entered the sand-covered ring. A herald blew his trumpet, and the two monarchs, Francis of France and Henry of England, rushed at each other. Henry immediately applied a front body hold. He lifted the French king high into the air and hugged him in a bear-like grip. Francis almost crushed, wheezed, puffed, and groaned, and putting forth a great last effort, he squirmed loose long enough to back-heel his opponent. The king of England hit the dirt with a resounding thud. His face purple with rage and shame, Henry rose and left the gathering. He broke off the discussions and shortly afterwards withdrew from all alliances with France. And that's how it is that Francis I of France, by means of his prowess as an athlete, lost England's valuable aid in his struggle with Charles V of Austria. By 1550, after many years of unrelenting war, Austria finally defeated France. And ever since, exponents of the gentle art of wrestling haven't hesitated to throw a match here and there, because they'll tell you it's better in the long run to cooperate with your opponents. And now here's Bill Brandt and a yarn that takes us back 20 years. Come in, Bill.
When it's 1926, the number one World Series story is always Alexander and Lazare. Bases full of Yankees in the last game. The Cardinals ahead by only one run. The seventh inning, two out. Here comes Alec from the bullpen. That long walk across the outfield of Yankee Stadium. And here's Alec in the box. Lazare at bat, ready to swing. The Yanks ready to run. Now Alec's ready to pitch. Here it is. Outside, ball one. Here it is again. Strike. No swing. Lazare just lets it go by. Now the next pitch. Boom. A long liner to left. It's heading for the stands. Lazare and all the Yankees are tearing along the baseline. But look, the ball is curving foul. It lands in the stands, but it's just a foul ball. Just a strike. Strike two. All the Yanks go back to their bases. Lazare trudges back from first base to home plate. Tony brandishes his bat again. Now the pitch. Lazare swings and misses. Strike three, and that's it. Alexander strikes out Lazare. The Cardinals are world champions. That's Sunday, October 10th, 1926, in New York. But our story now is October 5th in St. Louis, 5 days earlier, the third game of this seven-game series. The first two games were played in New York. Now here comes the World Series to St. Louis. In every city, the series brings a certain special type of hysteria, a combination of the Mardi Gras, New Year's Eve, and a Legion convention, all wrapped up in one whirling bundle of hoopla, and then something extra, too, something distinctly American. They don't have it anywhere else. And St. Louis in 1926 had it harder and louder than anywhere else I've ever been. St. Louis blows off the roof. Look, it's the first time. St. Louis has been looking at the World Series from the bottom up for 20 long years. And here it is, coming here at last. And it comes rolling in like drum fire, rising in tempo and volume for days and nights ahead of time. And then, wham, it explodes. And the blast reverberates to the Ozarks, makes old man Mississippi River rear like a two-year-old. There's nothing like it in all World Series history. What a night, that eve of battle. Monday night, October 4th. The series stands even, one game to one, an even break on those first two games in New York. And here come the Cardinals home, St. Louis's first pennant winner in the last 38 years. Thousands of fans at the railroad station. And all over town, it's a Roman holiday. Bells ringing, factory whistles blasting, firecrackers going off on every corner. Bands playing and fans raving wild. And so is Old Man River. The tide of fans around Union Station sweeps aside four lines of cops. And down at the waterfront, even the river is raring with elation and hooping it up for the Cardinals. Old Man Mississippi sets a new high water mark for many years, and there it is in the official figures. Right there at the station, a delegation of fans presents a $5,000 automobile to the Cardinal manager, Rogers Hornsby from Winters, Texas. And now the St. Louis team goes off on a big parade all over town. Bands, cheers, ticker tape. And the party goes on all night. Nobody sleeps. Half the town is up making noise. The other half has to stay up. And now it's Tuesday afternoon, and here we are at Sportsman's Park. It's jammed tight and pulsing with noise. And here's noise from the sky. Thunder. Look at those clouds. They're heavy, and they're black, and they're right over the ballpark. And 55 minutes before game time, here comes the rain. It's a downpour. The fans and the bleachers are soaked. Oh, boy. No game? Ah, the sun. Yes, the clouds move away. It's bright and sunny, and it's steaming hot. And that's just right for the Cardinal pitcher, Jess Haynes. Old Pop Haynes from Clayton, Ohio. But it's right for the Yankee pitcher, too. Dutch Reuther. Walter Reuther from Alameda, California. And here they go. They're red hot, both of them. It's no runs for either side the first three innings. And now it's the start of the fourth. Here comes that rain again. Yes, a sudden deluge. The umpires and players duck in a hurry. Bleacher fans get wet all over again. But it's all in fun. The clouds scamper away. Here comes the sun. Play ball. And it's a Yankee rally. Babe Ruth on second. Lou Gehrig and Lazeri to drive Babe home and break this scoreless tie. But old Pop Haynes knocks off Lou, then he knocks off Tony. Three out, no runs. Murderer's Row has come and gone, and hooray for Haynes. And now it's the Cardinals at bat in the fourth. First batter, Lester Bell from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Bing, a single to left. Now a sacrifice, then an intentional pass to catcher Bob O'Farrell from Waukegan, Illinois. This brings up Tommy Thevenau, the Cardinals shortstop from Madison, Indiana. The pitch, the swing, oh! Thevenau rolls one right at Lazeri. It's made to order for a double play. Tony flips the ball to second base to the Yankee shortstop, Mark Coney. That's one out. Coney pivots, the throw to first. It's wild. The ball gets away from Gehrig. Thevenau's safe. Lester Bell rounds third and comes charging home. A run. St. Louis one, New York nothing. And now you can hardly hear yourself think. Look, this batter, Jess Haynes. Come on, Jess. No, take it easy, Jess. You got one run. That's all you need, Jess, old boy. But old Jess is not taking it easy today. This is his day. Dutch Reuther, the Yankee pitcher, cocks his left arm, lets it go. Here's the pitch. Old Jess swings. Crash. It's way out to right field. It's going, going into the pavilion. Yes, a home run. A homer by the Cardinal pitcher. Now a burst of sound from the fans. A cataclysm of joy. It cracks the sky wide open. Jess Haynes trots majestically around the bases in back of Thevenau. The roar goes on and on, like water roaring through a broken dam. And it is a dam break of emotion, the pent-up feelings of a city hungry for the World Series for years and years. Another run in the fifth inning makes the final score 4-0. It's a shutout pitched by old Jess Haynes. Jess blanks Babe Ruth and all the great Yankee sluggers, so St. Louis will remember for all time this first World Series game ever played here, October the 5th, 1926. Then on top of that, Jess Haynes gives them something extra. He hits a home run himself, and his homer sends the whole city sky high and swinging on the stars. A once in a lifetime.
Thanks a lot, Bill Brand. Well, that's all we have time for today, fellas. We'll be back soon with another quarter hour of highlights and sidelights from the sports parade. Then once again, you'll hear the familiar call of AFRS Sports Reel. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.